If you can take the energy that you're putting on hard mode to every function of your business and take all that energy back and put it just into the product, you will have a much higher return on your effort. How do you create an unshakable business? I crossed $100 million in net worth by the age of 28. Now I'm growing acquisition.com into a billion-dollar portfolio. In this podcast, I share the lessons I've learned in scaling big businesses and helping our portfolio companies do the same. Buckle up and let's build. Today, I'm going to show you how to get ahead of 99% of businesses in 2024 and make loads of cash. Do you feel like everything in your business feels hard right now? Marketing, sales, customer success, finance, HR, everything you're doing every day? Or maybe you feel like you've increased sales, you've increased marketing, you've put people in place, you've got a new agency, and it's still not growing the business. Or maybe you got an all-star team, you took my advice, and you've got great people in place, and nothing is moving. Over the last 8 years that I have grown multiple businesses, including four of my own, to over $100 million, there's one thing that has remained consistent when these are the things that we're feeling in business. And that is, when you can't figure it out, when everything feels hard, when you can't put your finger on what's going on, it's because you have a lack of focus on product. And so what I want to do for you is I want to break your beliefs about product so you can actually grow your business. The first belief that I would like to impose upon you is that if you have built a sales and marketing engine and it is still not growing, your company is still not where you want it to be, it's not because you need more sales and marketing, it's because you need to focus on the product. In fact, the best and biggest companies spend very minimal time on sales and marketing because they know that a good product propels sales and marketing, and it makes them almost non-existent and easy. An example of this would be Cartier. In fact, if you go and ask the sales rep, what's your commission? And like, what was your sales aptitude? I've asked when I've gone in the store, is that they'll say they get less than 1% commission on most of the jewelry they sell. And why do they do that? Because Cartier says the product sells itself. The second belief that I want to impose upon you is that you are not spending enough time talking to your customers. Most founders think, oh, I spend a pretty good amount of time talking to my customers. But then if you go and ask them, let's look at the last month on your calendar, how much of that time was allocated to talking to customers? And what you'll find is that most of it is very minimal. And in fact, they don't have any direct contact. They only have contact through their team. And the third belief that I want to impose upon you is that you are not iterating your product enough to be great. Product is not stagnant. And if it remains stagnant, just like marketing, it will eventually go stale and it will not be cool. It will not be in demand. It will not be desirable anymore. And so the best companies that make the most money and have the most success are constantly iterating their product. So you're probably thinking, how do I know this? Well, I had this company. It was called Gym Launch. And it was my first company that I started. And constantly over the years, people were always looking at our marketing funnel, our sales funnel. They're trying to hack it. They're always booking calls. They're ghosting our sales guys, or they're getting on the calls and literally just going through the whole process. People are constantly taking our exact marketing funnel, our ads and everything, and taking sometimes to the degree where like I was on their business. They were literally posting the exact photos and images and ads, right? Because they thought that the secret to the growth that we had had was that we had insane sales and marketing. And little did they know, 99.9% of our time actually went to the product. The thing is, I didn't even know that was why we were successful. Because the reason that the product was so good was from a few reasons, right? Myself and my co-founder, aka my husband, Alex, we had both spent over a decade in the fitness industry. When we started the business, the reason that we started it is because we saw a void in the market. We said, you know what I would really like as the person who would want this product is I would have really liked this thing. Does that exist anywhere? We're like, I don't think it does. That'd be really cool if we built that. And then when we built that, we had so much tacit knowledge of the industry that we continued to iterate on the product over and over and over because we would look at it. It was so clear. It just wasn't done. It wasn't perfect. There was so much more that we could do. We could always do things better. And without knowing, we unconsciously were constantly iterating the product. And because we no longer were in the industry, but we were now people that were on the other side. We had a business in the industry. We were constantly talking to our customers. And the funny thing is that I didn't think of that as a job or a chore to do. I just really liked our customers and got along with them. So I talked to them all the time. And then when we were trying to figure out how to make the product better, I figured I should probably pull more of them together to talk to them and ask them what they think. Like if I want to know what to do to improve my company, I ask my team. If I want to know what to do to improve my product, it makes sense to ask my customers. It's funny because in hindsight, I look at it and I realize, I'm like, holy crap, we did all the right things. We completely focused on the product. While it was happening, it didn't feel like, oh, we must focus on the product. It felt like common sense. Talk to the people you sell stuff to. If you want to make something better, ask people what they want. If you want to find out if their money is where their mouth is, try and sell it to them and see if they'll buy it. And then it also made sense to me of like, constantly get better. You don't want the product to just be the same product it was a year ago, because that makes sense to me as a consumer. And so these things, when I say them out loud, I'm sure to you sound very much like common sense. And the funny thing is that when I say them, it does sound that way, but most companies still don't do it. So to put that theory to the test, with two of our first portfolio companies, I said, okay, I really think that the reason that our company was successful was from the product, not from the sales and the marketing. I think that that was gasoline on the fire, but the fire was the product itself. And so with two of our first companies, we implemented a rigorous system for making sure the product was constantly iterated and they were constantly talking to customers and they were constantly putting the focus there so that it could make sales and marketing easy. I don't think it's a coincidence that those are the two largest companies in our portfolio, both over $100 million now. So what I want to talk about now is how do you find product market fit and what constitutes a great product? How do you know when you actually have a great product? When you look at a purchase decision, what it is essentially a decision based on the match between the offer in the marketplace and the desire of the consumer. So it's what do you offer and what do they want and do they overlap enough for a purchase to occur? When purchases occur easily with little friction, that is when you have product market fit. There's no calculation to determine that you have product market fit. There are a lot of different measures that you can use. I would say this, you have product market fit when feels easy, when you don't have to nail every single piece of marketing and every single piece of sales, but when the friction between the person seeing the product and buying it is very low, it is easy to make the purchase. And so essentially what it is that they have more reasons to buy than not to buy. And so if you look at your product and you look at your target market, the people that you sell it to, the question is, do they have more reasons to buy it or more reasons not to buy it? And you want to have more reasons to buy your product. That could mean that they want it more, that there are less options, that it is more innovative than a competitor. It could mean that it is a better price. It could mean that you come with different features. You want to essentially stack the odds in your favor by creating an offer that's so compelling that it makes it a no-brainer to buy it. And when you're able to do that, that is when you achieve product market fit. Said simply, if what you're selling is something people want to buy, they will buy it. If people are not buying what you have, then you don't have product market fit. At the end of the day, the best thing to prove product market fit is just sales velocity. How much are you selling and at what rate? How easy is it to sell or how hard is it to sell? If you can sell something fast and easy, that means product market fit. If it feels slow and hard, you likely don't have product market fit. So I'm sure that some of you, if you're as old as me or older, so half of you probably don't know this, there used to be this thing called BlackBerry, and BlackBerry came out around the same time as Apple. And BlackBerry and Apple essentially competed for the market. And who won? Obviously, Apple won. Now, why did Apple win? Well, they had a better user experience. They had a better price point. They had more of the features that people wanted in a phone. And so some people did buy the BlackBerry, but it made it much harder for BlackBerry to succeed because Apple existed, which was a better alternative, and it was more of a desired match than BlackBerry. It had more of the things people wanted and less of the things they didn't want. And at the end of the day, that's what you want. How can you create a product that has more of what people want and less of what they don't want? So here's a question. If you have sales and you have customers, do you have product market fit? The answer is actually no. Let me give you an analogy. I can go to the gym, I can work out, and I can eat healthy. Does it mean I'm in amazing shape? Well, there's lots of people that go to the gym, they eat healthy, but they're not in amazing shape. So just because I go to the gym and I eat healthy doesn't mean I'm in shape. Just because people buy your product and you do make money doesn't mean you have product market fit. Product market fit happens to a degree. It is not a binary outcome. There is no yes, no to product market fit. If people are buying it, you have it to a degree. It's just to what degree do you have it? And what you want is to have it to a high degree, which means it feels easy. People who have it to a low degree, it feels slow. And so it's more of a dichotomy to manage rather than a problem to be solved. People are buying the thing you have. That means that you have it to a degree. It's just to what degree do you have it and how can you sway it more in your favor? Which brings the next question, which is, how do I know if I have product market fit to a high degree? Well, here's what it looks like when you don't have product market fit. Customers are not telling their friends about the product. Salespeople are not happy about how many sales they're making of the product. Marketing, the cost of marketing is very high. The reviews are not out of this world. And the sales cycles take too long. If all of those things are occurring, then it's likely that you have very low product market fit. Someone who has very high product market fit, typically what it feels like is a very short sales cycle, lots of great reviews, tons of referral traffic because people are constantly telling their friends, a very happy sales team because their job is not very hard, and tons of good word of mouth. So word on the street is always good. So if you're listening to this and you're thinking, gosh, I think I have product market fit, but it's definitely not to the degree I want it to be. Like I've definitely got a slow sales cycle or my sales team is complaining or like the marketing cost is pretty high, then I want you to ask yourself a series of questions. First, identify the people that you sell to. Who's your market? What is the desire of that market? Easy question. It has nothing to do with your product, but what do the people want in your market? The second is what of their desires are already being met. So they want this, list out all the things they want. Of all the things they want, what things are already taken care of? The third question is what desires are not met? So if you remember when I talked about Gym Launch, when we started it, what did we identify accidentally with no knowledge at all? It's just a hole in the market. Hey, you know what doesn't exist that would be really cool is this thing. We should build that. That's exactly when you're asking in question three. And the last question to that is, how big is the collection of buyers that want the thing that doesn't exist? So what a great product does is it solves an important set of unmet needs for a large pool of buyers. So let's take an example. I'm going to take one from the beauty industry, which is hair extensions. So what used to be is that people had hair extensions that they just put in and they would have to take out at the end of the day. And I happen to be one of those people that use those hair extensions. And what I hated was two things. One, at the end of the night, every night, I felt like a freaking naked mole rat because I had to take out my hair in front of my husband. And I was like, hold on, I got to take out my extensions. It felt very unfeminine, for one. It was a pain in the ass. It took a lot of time. And I was annoyed because I was like, man, I want my hair to look good all of the time. I don't want it to just look good some of the time. Another downside of that is that when I went swimming, when I went to a pool, I couldn't keep them in because a lot of times they would fall out. And so what was the desire I had? The desire I had was to have long, thick, luscious hair. Now, what desire was currently being met? Well, during most of the day, I had long, luscious hair. Now, what desire was not being met was that I didn't have the hair all the time. I didn't have the hair in certain situations. And most importantly, people knew I had extensions. Why? Because I couldn't wear them all the time. And so the desire that I had to be unseen, for people to not know the hair was fake, was not being met. Insert permanent extensions, NBR, tape-ins, clip-ins, K-tips. The reason for those is because there was a huge pool of women who didn't want people to know they had fake hair. And so the question was, how many women don't want people to know they had fake? Ton of them didn't want people to know they had fake hair. So now what? If you look at the market for fake hair, there's a larger market, a huge market for permanent extensions rather than clip-ins. And that is how those were born, is because there's an unmet need from the clip-in extensions themselves. Now, the next piece, if you've walked through that and you're like, I think I understand the unmet need, is let's put it through what we call the Ellis test. Sean Ellis was the co-founder of the growth hacking movement, and he coined this term. The test is to ask the buyers, how would you feel if you could no longer use this product? Then what you do from that test is you're going to measure the amount of people who say very disappointed. And that makes it clear that this product is a must to them. So for example, let's use the same example we just had of hair extensions. If somebody said you can never have permanent hair extensions again, I would be pissed. And so what you want is you want over 40% of people to say that they would be very disappointed. And if over 40% of people say that they would be very disappointed if your product no longer existed, then you have very high product market fit. Another clear example of a product that people would be very disappointed, and probably you watching would be, is YouTube. That is a product to a lot of people, and it's a great alternative to traditional education, is watching people through YouTube. If it didn't exist, I bet you over 40% of people would be very disappointed that it didn't. To go along with that, let's say a laptop. If you didn't have the laptop or computer upon which you're watching YouTube, I'm sure you'd be very disappointed not to be watching YouTube and not to be using the computer. Now, let's go a little bit more granular. I'm sure that everyone has something in their life that you are a unique buyer for, meaning like you are a subset of like there's humans, right? And like I would say the greater population and most of us like laptops and iPhones and social media. But let's take it down niched a little bit. Are there products that you can think of that you buy over and over and over again that you love? You would be very disappointed if they didn't exist. I can think of the few I've got for myself. One example is there's a protein bar called a Built Bar. It's 130 calories and it's high in protein. It's the lowest calorie protein bar that I can find that doesn't bother my stomach. And if I can't buy them or they're out of stock, I'm pissed. I'm lit. And so without Built Bars, I'm like, this sucks, right? When we went to Mexico and I had to buy these like nasty, chalky protein bars, I was just like disappointed the entire time. Another thing that I buy that I would be pissed if I didn't have is I buy popcorn seasoning to put on salad. And the reason I do that is because it saves me calories. And so if I forget my popcorn seasoning when I go to a restaurant, I'm very upset and I'm very disappointed because I have to use something else to flavor it, which either if I want to go the low calorie route is salt. And if I go the high calorie route, it's dressing, which then means there's more calories, which means fat. And so I am very disappointed when I don't get to use either of those products. If you want to take it to a different route, I would say like my Dyson Airstraight, because what do I do with that? Well, it saves me time because it blow dries and straightens my hair at once. So how did they find product market fit? Well, they said, oh my gosh, there's a market for girls that want to blow dry their hair. Where's the unmet need for a lot of girls? Well, what they don't like is the amount of time they have to spend doing their hair because they have to dry it and then they have to straighten it. There comes the Air Straight, which dries and straightens at the same time. So why would I be very disappointed if I didn't have that product? Because it would eliminate 20 minutes of my life twice a week that I have just gotten back. And so that is the understanding of product market fit that I can find. And I see it in things all around me all the time. The question is, have you built a product that would truly disappoint customers if they didn't have it? Or did you just copy somebody else's product? Which means like there's virtually no way that you'll have product market fit because you just copied somebody else, which means the demand is already met, right? Their need is already solved. You're just another one of the people in the market. And so that's why I like to walk people through this exercise because business is hard if your product sucks. And a lot of people don't know their product sucks because they get enough money and enough sales to have a business. You can get a business to 10 million a year, 15 million a year and not have product market fit. But I can tell you what it feels like inside those businesses and it's hard day after day. And I know that because I look at hundreds of businesses every week who don't have it. And if you can take the energy that you're putting on hard mode to every function of your business and take all that energy back and put it just into the product, you will have a much higher return on your effort. Guys, I just want to take a quick break to thank all of you for listening to the show so far. If you enjoy what you're listening to, I would be so grateful if you would just consider leaving me a review or even sharing it with somebody who you think would love to hear the kind of content. As you can see, I don't run ads on here, so the only way that this show grows is if we can continue to make awesome content, and the only way I can do that is through you liking, subscribing, and rating. All right, let's get back to it. When you are able to build a company around a product that doesn't have strong product market fit, what I say when I see these companies and what our team says is they have made it their true brute force effort. They have 10 out of 10 marketing. They have 10 out of 10 sales. They have 10 out of 10 HR, customer success, finance, meaning they are doing all the right things in every department. They're following the right playbooks. They have watched our content to a T. And for some reason, it feels hard. They're still losing customers way more than they could ever expect. They're still not getting customers at the cost they would expect. They're still having to alligator wrestle people to buy their product. And they're still losing employees on a consistent basis, despite putting a ton of effort into getting the right talent. These are local issues that tie back to a global issue, which is that your product sucks and people don't want to buy it enough to keep you in business. And so you have to compensate by trying to make every other function 10 out of 10 because your product is a 1 out of 10. And the thing is that you can only compensate so long. I mean, I've seen businesses have compensated for a while, but they're miserable for the most part because everything feels hard. It's like living on hard mode. And the easier thing to do, which I'd say it's harder in the short term, easier in the long term, is to refocus on the product and rethink. Is this the best way for me to deliver value to a customer? Is this the most valuable thing I can deliver to a customer? And then ask yourself, am I serving the right customers? If this is the most valuable thing you can deliver and they do not want to buy it, then maybe you have the wrong customer. If it's not the most valuable thing you can deliver, then maybe you have the wrong product. And so at the same time, for some people, the reason that your product sucks is that you do not understand your customer base. For other people, you understand your customer base, but you have not put enough time into the product. It's typically one or the other. Either way, it creates this business that's just run on hard mode. And I've seen it many times where I walk into a business, I look at it and I'm like, oh, they don't have product market fit. But with a few configurations, we can get them there. And the cool thing is that if you are playing on hard mode and you've maxed out every other function in your business, and then you change the product, then you're set up for success. Because then you can hit the gas and you can capitalize on all this value that you have essentially missed out on over the last however many years that you've had your business. So if you're still sitting here and you're thinking, that's all well and good, but I'm still confused as to, do I have a great product or not? I want to walk you through some metrics that you can apply to your business so you can analyze if you actually have a great product. The first frame that I will give you to analyze if you have a good product or not is the model itself, which is the purchasing model of your product. There's four types of purchases. The first one is a one-time purchase, meaning the customer buys the product one time and never again. The second would be multiple purchases, which might mean the customer buys the product and then a year or 2 years or 3 years later buys a product again. The third would be that you have repeat customers buying 3, 4, 5, 6 times, but it is at an irregular interval, meaning they buy it, but you cannot predict when they're going to buy it again. And the last one would be recurring. Recurring is when the customer consistently buys your product over and over and over again at a predictable rate. And so on that scale, if you're thinking about what is the best in terms of your product, what you want is recurring. That is the ultimate desire that you have, because if you have recurring revenue for your product, what it means is you have a product people want to buy over and over and over again. So an example of this one would be Netflix. People pay the subscription every month. Another one would be hair extensions. I'm definitely not taking those out. I buy them every 6 months. Another one of those would be food items. There's lots of food that people have been buying week after week after week, and they keep in their fridge. Those are all recurring products. All of us have recurring products in our life that we feel like it's almost unconscious that we're even paying for them because we are so dependent on them at this point. That is the best kind of product to have, is one that has recurring purchases. Everything else, the issue with it is that it is less predictable. And so if you want to understand, like, the first measure is, to what degree do you have product market fit, is where does your product fall on that spectrum? What is the purchase rate of your product currently? So if a customer is buying your product on a regular basis or on a recurring basis, that likely indicates that you have higher product market fit. Whereas if a customer is buying your product one time and then never interacting with your company again, you likely have low product market fit. And the other two would say that you're in the middle. The second way to measure product market fit is through price. And I would say what this means is through gross margins. So, like, for example, at acquisition.com, when we look at the gross margins of a business, that tells me if they have high product market fit or not because of this. It is a measure of how much of your product cost you can pass on to your customer. The more desire somebody has for a product, the more they will pay, therefore the more cost you can pass on. Meaning that if you have higher product market fit, then you will have better gross margins. Or said a different way, how much of a premium can you charge for your product or service? How high of a price point can you demand for? And so that's the second frame that I want you to put this through, is how much of a premium do you have on your product or service? What are your gross margins? How much of the cost can you pass on to the customer because their willingness to pay is so high? An example of this would be Truff hot sauce. Most hot sauce costs anywhere around like $4.99 to $5.99, maybe at the higher end, like $9.99. Truff came in and they charged anywhere from $15 to $35 for a bottle of hot sauce. Hot sauce, which means the willingness to pay of the customer is incredibly high. And why? Because I think anyone that's tried Truff would say they have a hot sauce like no other. I can't live without it. I eat it on everything. I happen to be one of those people. I love Truff. I buy it religiously. I think it tastes better than all the other hot sauces. Therefore, I am willing to pay more to have the product. Now, let's look at a product that has low gross margins. Let's just take milk, okay? Normal whole milk. Typically at the store, it's going to be under $10 for a gallon of milk. It is pretty cheap, and the gross margins on that are low. Why is that? Well, it's become commoditized, meaning there are lots of people that meet the need in the marketplace. There are lots of people or companies that sell milk. Now, how could you actually innovate on that and create a higher willingness to pay? Is create something that tastes like milk that doesn't have dairy, lactate. Look how much they charge. They charge about 50% more. Look at something that doesn't have allergies. Look at cashew milk or almond milk, right? Which is avoiding most of the allergies, which they also charge about 50% more. And so they have a higher willingness to pay because they have met the unmet need in the marketplace, which is for people like me who are lactose intolerant, who can't have milk, but would like to have it because it tastes good. They have created a product for that. Whereas milk has not innovated on itself, right? And so milk has a low willingness to pay. And typically people are just buying it based on the price because there are so many companies that meet the need. And then the last one is just price, which is how much is your customer willing to pay for your product in comparison with your competitors? If somebody is willing to pay more for your product in comparison to everybody else on the market, then that means that you have high product market fit. When we start our company, Gym Launch, a company that you could say would be even in the same stratosphere, because I did feel it was very different compared to most companies, to be fair, they would charge probably anywhere around $500 a month for their product on the high end. Our product cost in the first month $4,000. And for the first year, it was $38,000. So what does that tell me? It tells me that we had high product market fit. People were willing to pay more for our product or service than they were any other company. Because the reality is, if somebody can get the same product or service from a different company that charges less, they will do it. But if you offer something that those companies do not offer and you meet the need that they have not met, then they will pay more for it. So an example is that for me, for example, let's look at the eyelash industry. So we had glue-on eyelashes, which is what girls were doing for years. It's what I did all through college and high school, right? And then came in, because what we hated was having to take them off, put them on, et cetera, right? Then what came in was eyelash extensions, which is you go into a place, they put eyelash extensions on your eyes, they last for about 2 weeks, and then you go back and you have to get them done again. Unmet need in the marketplace was that going into the eyelash place, it would take about 2 hours where you just lie there with your eyes closed and then you get your eyelashes put on, right? The other piece to it was that they would fall off quite frequently. And in order to fix them, you would have to go into the studio again. You couldn't fix it on your own. Introduce Lashify, Falscara. What did they find in the market? They found the unmet need, which was that women wanted an option to have a more natural looking eyelash that didn't take 2 hours every 2 weeks and that they could fix themselves if it fell off. That's why they're blowing up. So to buy 2 weeks worth of the fake eyelashes costs me about 50% of what it would to get my eyelash extensions for a month. But I still pay it, even though I know I'm going to have to pay more frequently, which means they actually end up being around the same price because I like the flexibility, I like the freedom, and I get the time back. And so my willingness to pay is higher because I have all these other needs that are met that are not met when I go to an esthetician that does my eyelash extensions. So for example, the best products, they are going to be recurring, high margin, and high price. So some other examples outside of the beauty industry would be like enterprise software, you know, signing up for HubSpot or Salesforce. Like those are great products because they are recurring, they are high gross margin, and they are high price. A completely other example would be a country club or golf club membership. Those things have waiting lists of hundreds and hundreds of people because of the amount of value that they provide in a local area that has an unmet need. And so I want you to think, where does your product fall within this? Do you have recurring? Do you have high gross margins? Do you have a high price? Where do you fall? Or is it, do you have one-time purchases, low gross margins, and a really low price? Or do you fall somewhere in the middle? I think most people end up falling somewhere in the middle, in which case the question is, what would it take to get it to the other end? So now that you've identified what is product market fit, how do you figure out if you have product market fit, and where do you fall on the spectrum, because it's not binary? What we want to talk about now is just how to improve your product. The first one is talk to your customers. So the way that I did that when we were growing Gym Launch is that one time a month, we had a group and we called it our inner circle. And these were people who basically, we gave them a very small discount on a recurring basis to meet with us once a month to share with us what was working best with the product, what was not working, and what they would want to see improve. And so we would pull a focus group. It'd be anywhere from 2 to 3 hours, one time a month. And in exchange, they got a little discount on the product. And what we got was all the information we needed to know what was going on with our customers. Now, the second way that we did this is we did have a lot of customer events. And this is a huge upside to people that have, you know, software products. They've got products that they don't get to see and talk with the customers frequently, is that you can host events where you get to meet the customers. You could also use it as an upsell opportunity if you want to capitalize on that. But I think one of the most beneficial things about us having a semi-annual event is that we got to talk to people, we got to hear their stories, and we got to hear what they liked and what they didn't like. Now, the third thing that you can do is you can ensure that your team is constantly talking to your customers and documenting the conversations. So most people have some sort of customer success or customer service team. You've got people who talk to the customers. You could also have, maybe it's a finance team. Maybe they're just trying to collect payments. Whatever it is, whoever's talking with the customers, the thing is that they're not thinking about the product on a daily basis because they're trying to do their jobs. But what I used to do in Gym Launch is that once a month, I would survey everybody who's in a customer-facing role. And I would ask them the questions. What do you think if we added to the product would make it a product that people would never want to leave? That was the first question I would ask. The second question I would ask is that what if we took away from the product do you think would cause everyone to leave? Those were the two questions I would ask. I didn't give too much context. That's the two things I want to say. Now, you could also ask this directly to your customers, but I also liked getting it from a team perspective. It's just understanding, like, what would make more people stay? What would make more people go? And the thing is, I think oftentimes we think, gosh, there's no way that my team, who has none of the same knowledge or information, all this insight on business that I do at the top of my ivory tower, would know how to improve my product. You know who invented the Frappuccino? It was a barista at Starbucks. She invented it. She made it for a customer out of thin air. Most of the innovations actually at Starbucks come from the front line or baristas, the people talking to the customers all day. They're the ones that receive the feedback. Whoever's closest to the feedback has the most information or knowledge on the product and on the customers. So it makes sense that they would understand what are the unmet desires, that if we could meet those desires, we could have a better product, we could improve our product, and we could charge more. So what that means for you is, you as the CEO or founder of the business who has all this information, all this tacit business knowledge, imagine if you talk to more customers. What kind of ideas would you come up with? If the barista can come up with the Frappuccino, imagine what Howard Schultz could come up with. The next thing you want to do, or the second step, is that you want to take all the information from the survey you give to your team, the information you collect with your customers, and you want to write all of it down in a list. And then what you want to do with that list is you want to prioritize it. And you want to say, what things did you most frequently hear from your customers? Like features that they mentioned, products that they mentioned, whatever it might be, extra add-ons to your service, whatever it was. The highest frequency things that were mentioned from all the interactions, those go at the top of the list. And then you can add everything else below, because essentially what you want to do is create a product backlog. This is something that's done in software. People don't often do it in other businesses, at least other small businesses. Big businesses always have a product roadmap. And that's essentially what this is. If you're watching this and you're like, ah, this is a product roadmap. Yes, it's a product roadmap. This is like base level, like very scrappy product roadmap, which is just, let's write down in a list in order of importance the things that we're going to do to the product. Now, does that mean we do them all at once? No, it means that we're going to try to do the highest things or the highest return things on the product sooner, which means which one of these things on this list of 30, if done tomorrow, would provide the company and the customer with the highest return? That is the first thing you want to do. Return means it would improve product market fit the most. That's the first thing you want to start with. And then everything should go within that order down, because you always want to be putting your effort into the constraint that's going to provide you with the highest return on your effort. And then what you want to do with that list is, I want you to revisit it every 4 weeks. And I want you to say, does this order and do these things still make sense given the knowledge I have now? Because here's the thing. What can happen is that you have this list. You're like, I'm amazing. I'm set for like 2 years. Do you think things in the market are going to change in 2 years? Think about how many things have changed for your phone. Think about how many things have changed with the software you use. Think about how many things have changed with the clothing you buy in the last 2 years. That is the same rate of change that your product will most likely experience if you want to have high product market fit. Products are constantly iterating, and there is all of this list that you have, and then there is what is happening in the marketplace. And you have to be able to look at the two and say, are these things still relevant? And is this order still the best order? And that's what you want to be looking at every 4 weeks to make sure that you are on track. And then the third step to fixing your product is to constantly iterate and commit to testing and learning. So we have this phrase we say at acquisition.com, is we say, we're going to test and learn. Does that mean that everything we try is something that sticks? No. So a lot of people get really intimidated. They're like, well, I don't know about changing this because we're not changing it. We're just going to try this. We're going to try everything. We're going to try one thing at a time, see the result, and then decide if we're going to move forward or not. Do we need to change it? Do we need to improve it? What do we need to do differently? So I want you to approach your product with an experimental mindset, because the best companies are always doing that. They're just throwing stuff out there and saying like, I think this is what they want. Let's try and see. You know, let's pitch to a few customers. Let's make an MVP and let's get it out there. Let's make a limited supply and let's sell it. There's a lot of ways that you can try to crank down on the list that you have, and you can do it in a safe environment where you're not committing to a long-term, like 1 to 2 year product change. And so there's two ways that people go wrong here. One is that they think that this list is now the Bible that they must go by and that every change must occur and it is permanent. And that's not the case. This list will probably change. Things will get thrown out. Things will change. And lots of it will be temporary and seasonal. It will be cyclical. And maybe it will work for a year and then won't work for the next year. The second place that people go wrong is that they test too much at once. You're watching this and you're like, I'm going to be the one that does the best. And so you say, I'm going to do all of it at once. But the thing is, when you do all of it at once, how do you know what causes the success? So when you really dramatically increase product market fit, how do you know which thing it was that you did? And not knowing what causes success is just as dangerous as knowing and doing nothing. And so we want to make sure that we isolate the variables and we only test one thing at a time. And so let's say that hypothetically, you take this and you actually act on it and you do something to your product. What are the things that would have to happen to prove that you now have better product market fit? So let's take what we talked about in the beginning, what it feels like when it's really hard and you don't have it, and let's reverse engineer that. Well, if you have a really good product that's really compelling and then it fills the need for an unmet desire, you probably have an easy time marketing it. So you probably actually don't need as skilled of a team to even market it, because the product basically markets itself, because there's nothing else out there that does what it does. That would also mean that sales would probably be fairly easy, because if there's nothing else out there that does what it does, it means that it'd probably be an easy time selling customers. In fact, it wouldn't really be a sale. It'd be more of like, I don't know, taking orders. So you probably wouldn't need as big of a sales team. You probably wouldn't have to pay as much commission. And the other side, you probably wouldn't need some huge customer success or customer service team, because I doubt that people would be inquiring, saying they were complaining about the product much, because there's nothing else like it. Why would they complain when there's no alternatives? On the other side, you're probably not worrying about how much money you're making, because you're probably making money hand over fist. And so you see how there's this trickle effect that if you have a fantastic product, it goes into every other area of the business, and that's how you make loads of money. It's not from cranking the marketing and cranking the sales. Yes, you can have high revenue. I know lots of companies that have their sales and marketing machines, and they have like this big of a margin. And complaints everywhere. And they'll probably be shut down the next year or two from the FTC. So that being said, if you focus on the product, everything becomes easy. It starts to feel like you can't build the company fast enough because there's so much demand for what you have. The constraint is no longer the product. The constraint is how fast you can build the mousetrap behind it. And that is when you really know you've got product market fit. So I want to make this actionable. Because you implement nothing, you actually did not learn. Learning means that you have a change in behavior. So I want to give you 4 things you can do to change your behavior, aka get smarter. The first thing is determine who owns the product. Who is product owner? It's probably you if you have a very small company. If you have a larger company, I would say that typically somebody in customer success or sales is also tends to be apt with product. So it doesn't need to be someone's full-time job right now. You need someone that can help own this process, right? This very light process at the moment. The second is you want to set up with that person, whether it's you or somebody else, a regular cadence for talking to customers. What group of customers are you going to meet with on a regular basis? Set up the recurring meeting and then give them an incentive to do this with you. Third is create your backlog. Create your list in order of what you're going to do to make the product better. And then make sure that you or the person who owns the product is checking it once a month to decide, is this still relevant? Do I need to change anything? Has anything changed in the market? And the last one is determine what you're going to start off with. What's your first test? What's the first thing that you're going to do after doing all those things to make your product better? So the question really is, what one of these things can you commit to over the next 30 days?